And welcome back, everybody, to the Cold War Cast. I am your host, Ryan Llewellyn. This is a podcast where we discuss the history and the pop culture of the Cold War. Today we're going to talk about the Turkish contingent in the Korean War. This is a fascinating story in and of itself, but it also ties in with the larger Cold War that was shaping up around the situation. And we're going to talk about the history of it and some of their actual experiences in the Korean War. I think this will be a really fun episode. While back ago, we did an episode about the Ethiopians in the Korean War, and this will be kind of along the same tones as that one. Before we go too much further, we have to acknowledge that, well, right now there's a war going on between Ukraine and Russia, and this is something that is definitely making the Cold War more relevant these days. There's a lot of topics coming up that, you know, just in mainstream discourse that really tie into the Cold War. And we are going to get through this and then start tackling some of those, I think, and trying to answer some of the questions that a lot of people are having out there in the world that relate to this situation. So anyway, when I first set off on this story, I kind of figured that it would be more of a interesting curiosity than anything, but I did find some things that end up being very consequential to the Cold War going forward, and we'll get into that. So anyway, the Korean War happened in 1950, and when the communist forces of the North came south, the United Nations reacted by passing Resolution 82, which condemned the actions of North Korea, and then passed Resolution 83, which asked for assistance from the member states of the United Nations for the South Koreans. So as you can expect, when that came up, America, of course, was the first one to say, yes, we'll help, you know, we're the ones that drafted the thing, you know, more or less. But the second nation to respond to the United Nations call is kind of surprising, and that nation is Turkey. And so we have to ask, why would Turkey be so enthusiastic about a war halfway across the world that there seems to be no connection? Well, and, you know, plus also, too, they were probably the most significant country to sit out of World War II, you know, either between them and Spain. I know towards the end of the war, they hitched their wagons with the Allies, just kind of more for posterity's sake. But they weren't actively a participant in the Second World War. And pretty much the only country of note that didn't, off the top of my head. But why would they want to be involved in this fight now? Well, the main reason is because the Russians were really breathing down their throat. And in order to really understand where Turkey was at the time, we have to go back a little bit in history. Now, of course, they were on the losing side of World War I as the Ottoman Empire, and the Ottoman Empire crumbled, became the Turkish Republic, and there was a lot of calamity in the former Ottoman Republic. And really, it's a very fascinating story in itself as far as how that cookie crumbled. And after they had lost World War II, one of the consequences of that was that the Bosphorus Straits, and now that is the strait that goes right through the middle of the city of Istanbul. And it's a big shipping channel between the Black Sea and ultimately into the Mediterranean Sea. And it is really cool. I've been to Istanbul, and if you're on the west side of the Bosphorus, you are in the continent of Europe. And if you cross the Bosphorus, you're in Asia. And, you know, there's bridges you can drive over, ferries you can take. I remember when we went there, we decided we were going to take a ferry across the Bosphorus to a restaurant just so we can say we went to Asia for dinner one night. But it's a very, very important piece of real estate on the planet. But the Bosphorus Straits, they were internationalized. And I believe it was the Montreux Convention. Everybody got together and decided the terms of how things were going to work for the Bosphorus. And long story short, it was a little annoying to the Soviet Union because, you know, for one thing, it kept them strong in the Black Sea. Other powers that had no Black Sea connections were very limited on the ships they can bring into the Black Sea, but it also limited what could come out of the Black Sea. So the Soviet Union wasn't going to be able to fully project power outside of, at the other end of the Bosphorus Strait, so into the Mediterranean. And this was a little annoying to them that a country, annoying to the Soviet Union, that is, that a country perceived to be a smaller, weaker, kind of basket case country, like Turkey, could dictate their vital lifelines, really, to the west of the world. So the Soviet Union, of course, has a lot of coastline, but you know, not a lot of it's warm water. You've pretty much got the port in Vladivostok, which of course is just multiple time zones away from you know, the main heart of Russia, and then down here in this Black Sea area. So they really need this warm water port. This is very, very important to them. And the region surrounding, you know, more or less the Bosphorus, was becoming more and more important to the Soviet Union and the world. Middle Eastern oil was really in hot demand, and the oil fields of the southern part of the Soviet Union, Azerbaijan and so forth, was tied in with shipping through the Bosphorus. And you know, also too, just to go back a little bit to World War II, the reason the Battle of Stalingrad was so important was because it was the transportation link basically between this region and the heart of Russia, you know, being Moscow and the industrialized areas that we think of, really. So they felt that this region, and most specifically the Bosphorus, was very, very important to their survival as a nation. Look at it on a map, you know, you and look at the way Russia is situated, and it'll be obvious that just right there, the most important part of Turkey, the Bosphorus, the city of Istanbul, Tsargrad, as the Russians would call it, is a real prize for them. So the Soviet Union, they suggested that this treaty that the world had signed, you know, 10 years later or whatever, or 10 years earlier, should be up for negotiation again, and that the Bosphorus Straits should be a joint project between the Turks and the Soviet Union. The Turks knew that this would not be a good deal for them, and that I believe there's an old Middle Eastern adage that, you know, once the camel gets his nose in the tent, the whole thing comes in. And this is what probably would have happened if the Soviet Union got a little bit of a foothold there in the Bosphorus, that ultimately it would lead towards Turkey becoming a communist country, or at the very least having a lot of real social discord because of the communist presence. And, you know, keep in mind too, Turkey, it would be a very new democracy on the world stage. They only did that some 25 years earlier, so they weren't exactly established in the same way that you might think of, you know, the United States or France, Great Britain, and so forth, with these democratic institutions. They felt that they would be a little bit too vulnerable to have the communists come in without serious consequences. Then there were also some pretty credible rumors floating around that the Soviet Union just, well, planned on taking the Bosphorus by force when they wanted to. Apparently, before the before Operation Barbarossa, when the Soviet Union and Germany were on friendly terms, the Soviet delegation had told the Germans that ultimately that is their plan. You know, who knows if that's true or not, but if you're a country like Turkey and that gets back to you, you're going to be a little bit worried about that. Also, too, on the other end of the Turkish nation in eastern Anatolia, there were threats of the Soviet Union taking land that would have been considered Armenian, perhaps, and incorporating that into the Armenian Republic within the Soviet Union. And the land that they wanted was actually quite a bit, and a lot of it was along the Black Sea, which would have really damn near encircled the Black Sea on the Turkish coast. And that was a very credible threat. Of course, the Turks and the Armenians, to say that they had a bit of a dispute, that'd be the understatement of the 20th century. That was quite the ordeal there. And Turkey really was worried that it would be easy for the Soviet Union to grab this up. So they looked for a friend in the world. And that friend in the world, of course, would be the United States. We left World War II as the world's premier superpower. We were about the only way that Turkey could really counter the Soviet threat to their north. So Turkey decided that they were going to hitch their wagon to the United States any way that they could. And the United States, we looked at the situation in Turkey too with alarm, that we didn't want the Soviet Union encroaching into the Middle. I know Turkey's technically not Middle Eastern, but it's kind of the gateway into the Middle East. And if the Soviet Union was to take Turkey or flip Turkey into its orbit one way or another, it would give them better access to the oil fields in places like Iraq, Saudi Arabia, Iran, and so forth. Now, what the United States did to counter the Soviet threat to Turkey was basically give them a lot of money. And this is that was the Truman Doctrine. We actually did an episode on the old podcast a couple years ago about the Truman Doctrine. And long story short, what we did for Turkey is we sent them about $100 million in aid. And we sent a similar amount to the nation of Greece as well, too. And that aid was good enough in the case of Greece to kind of pull the government's chestnuts out of the fire and quell the communist insurgency there, because it was looking like in Greece that the communists were going to win. And now, in Turkey, this $100 million was good enough to bolster their armed forces and also improve some of their domestic infrastructure. I guess they got some better roads, kind of like what we were doing in the United States at the time with our interstate system. They didn't quite get an interstate system, but they were able to improve some things in part so they could move troops around it and be efficient that way too. That money made Turkey a little bit more formidable, and it also showed to the Soviet Union that the United States had some resolve in the area and really kind of changed the dynamics between the Soviet Union and Turkey at this time. Another thing that happened, and I believe this was in 1947 or 1948, was the aircraft carrier, the USS FDR, made a visit to Istanbul. And this was seen as the United States doing a show of force, but a supportive one, that we were going to send our carrier there to potentially back up the Turks. And this was at a point where tensions were getting very high between Turkey and the Soviet Union. The diplomatic guys that they sent the aircraft carrier there, it was pretty funny. I believe it was the Turkish ambassador to the United States had died in the United States, just, you know, of natural causes. And this aircraft carrier was sending the urn of his ashes back to Turkey. Normally, they would not do that for just a run-of-the-mill diplomat like that, you know, to show the American government's support or whatever. So it was kind of a convenient reason for this aircraft carrier to show up during this period of heightened tensions. And the Soviet Union took note of it and called it for what it was. So Turkey suggested that they should be able to join this new fledgling organization, NATO, and be a part of the Western alliance that way. And the nations of NATO turned the Turks down in 1950. They did it politely, kind of a thanks but no thanks. So when war broke out later in 1950 in Korea, the Turks saw this as a golden opportunity. So like I said, when the United Nations, you know, and when you see United Nations at this point, read the Americans, basically, we were calling the tune there. When it was asked for nations to send help to South Korea, that's why Turkey says that Turkey will not fail to meet her obligations. And Turkey put together a brigade of soldiers and got them ready to go. Now, when we talked about the Ethiopians, we said that the Ethiopians basically put together kind of like an all-star team of their military to send to Korea. And it was kind of the same deal with the Turks. They sent a lot of their best, a lot of their most ambitious officers, and some of their best trained troops. In the episode about Ethiopia, we talked about how sometimes these multinational coalitions, they send the least possible, hopefully to get the most out of it. So that's why you see sometimes, you know, just some random nation will send a platoon of water purification guys or, you know, some medical personnel, just basically enough to say that they did something and to maybe make it not very controversial on the domestic front. But Turkey sent a combat brigade right into the war, and they arrived in Korea on October 19th of 1950. When they arrived to Korea, they had about 3 weeks of training behind the lines, of course. And in this training, they were exposed to American weapons and some American procedures. I should also backtrack a little bit. They were under the logistical umbrella of the American Army at this time. So the American Army was going to be responsible for supplying them with everything and kind of guiding them along. Of course, they had their own leadership, but they were under the larger UN command, which was basically the Americans. And, you know, we were going to supply them and so forth. So they were trained on how to use our weapons, some of our procedures, like calling for fire and all that, and some of the basic tactics that we were planning to be using. And they were outfitted with the equipment that the Americans believed that the Turks would need. Now, this wasn't exactly a seamless process, because the Turks, they were so different from the Americans in a lot of ways. For one, the issue of food was actually a pretty big issue. The Turks, of course, the overwhelming majority of Turkey is going to be Muslim, and it's actually one of the most devout Muslim countries in the world. And they, of course, do not eat pork. Well, a lot of U.S. military rations have pork in it, you know, pork and beans and all that. So right off the bat, that was a problem. So they contracted with a company across the water in Japan and had them make special rations for the Turkish soldiers that did not contain pork. And They called these M rations as opposed to the C rations, M for Muslim, of course. This is similar to something that we did in the Iraq war, where we had special rations that we had made for the Iraqi troops. And basically, it was a humanitarian MRE packet that I think it has like some dry cereal, hot chocolate, you know, some stuff like that. And then there was actually an American company that made halal meals that were put into pouches that kind of looked like MRE pouches, but they were for the civilian market. And they were foods like curried lamb, different types of spiced chicken. And to be honest, whenever we came across these MREs, we always preferred those to our MREs, or, you know, at least it was a nice change of variety. So they were pretty good. If I ever actually came across those meals again, just, you know, at a store or something, I might buy some of them. But I'm sure the ones they had back in 1950 probably weren't so good. So I kind of digress. So they had to get special rations for them. And then also our idea of coffee is different from what the Turks' idea of coffee is. Of course, they like their coffee a bit stronger than the typical mess hall coffee that you would find, I guess, there. And also the idea of bread was different, where when we think of bread, it's going to be, you know, like sliced Wonder Bread or, you know, rolls, something along that. And the bread that they would prefer, the Turks, was going to be a much thicker, heartier bread. And ultimately, they did find a baker that could do something that I think had something to do with rice flour that they used and made a much more coarse bread that was more suitable to the Turks. And there were little things too, like the issue of showers. You know, in the military, of course, there's communal group showers. So everybody just gets naked and showers together. The Turks had a problem with this. They weren't going to go for that. So they end up making special showering areas for the Turkish soldiers too, where they had a little bit more privacy, which is kind of funny. You know, you associate the Turks sometimes with like their bathhouses and you know, oiling up and wrestling with each other. You think they'd be a little bit more comfortable with that, but I guess they really weren't. But those were just kind of minor things they can get wrong. The big one, of course, was language. And obviously, there weren't going to be any American soldiers that knew how to speak Turkish, and there were very few Turkish soldiers that knew how to speak English. So there was a big communications gap, and right off the bat, they realized this, that this was going to be a problem. They did put American liaison officers with the Turks, as they would have done with anybody, and part of their job was to kind of, you know, make everything run right. And it, you know, even then, there was a lot of confusion between the higher ups issuing orders and other directives to the Turks. To back up just a little bit, I watched a film to kind of prepare for this episode, a 2017 Turkish/Korean film. I believe both countries worked on this, called Ayla, Daughter of War. And it was a really good film. I'll talk about it more at the end. But the first parts of the film is the Turks getting over to Korea. And you get some of their reactions from dealing with the Americans and some of the cultural strains. One of them that I thought was funny was a guy was writing home about how the Americans powder all their food. Because, you know, at the time they had powdered food, just add water and heat and comes out. And it was talking about how a guy ate like a whole can of powdered eggs, like implying that he didn't add water. He just thought you were supposed to eat the powder. So I thought that was kind of funny. So anyway, back to Korea. The timeline that we're working with right here, remember I said that they came about the middle of October. And at this time, what had already happened was the North Koreans had basically bloodied the nose of the South Koreans and the Americans as well, too, and knocked everybody back on their heels. But when the Turks got there, it was about the time when the Americans were and the South Koreans were pushing back against these forces, and they were about to push into the north. And then all the so this is right before the big fighting that we typically think of, which of course happens around Thanksgiving time of 1950. So the Turks are trained as well as they can be in those 3 weeks to get up to speed to what's going on in Korea. And the American officers that observe them look at the Turks and say, yep, this is a good fighting force. They, you know, of course, these guys skipped out on World War II, so they don't have that combat experience, but they comport themselves like soldiers. They're proficient and they've got good soldierly demeanor, and their discipline is noteworthy. And actually, a lot of American press really took a liking to the Turks because just they looked so different. They all had these big mustaches, and they carried knives that just really big knives that almost looked like swords. So they looked like something just a little unworldly, I guess, compared to the Americans. I know a lot of old guys from this era that really attached a lot of mystique to the Turks. And, you know, there's a lot of just little anecdotes out there about how hardcore these guys are or how different. You know, I remember one old guy that was a Korean. I don't remember if the guy was actually in Korea, but he served in the army around that time. And, you know, it was pretty well established that the Turks were the most badass soldiers on earth at the time. I remember one old guy telling me, too, that the Turks would wear a pair of pants that were baggier in the hips and stick out. You know, you could probably imagine what I'm talking about, but they called them 7-day shitters. And this was because they were so disciplined that while they were out doing their thing, they wouldn't even stop to go to the bathroom. They would just fill up their pants over the course of a week. And then, you know, once they were done in the week, they would deal with their pants. Obviously, this isn't a true story, but it's just an example that kind of gives you an idea of some of the mystique surrounding the Turks. So anyway, after this training, the Turks were sent up to the front. And they were baptized in fire pretty quick. The late November of 1950, there was just a flurry of activity that the U.S. Army, the Marine Corps, the ROC forces, everybody was involved in. And the Turks were right there in the mix. The weather had dropped to sub-zero temperatures. And the Chinese, surprise, surprise, entered the war in force and really just caused all kinds of chaos and mayhem in the front and sent the United Nations command forces scrambling. Now, imagine being in a situation like that where you're not sure exactly what's going on. It's ungodly cold. Chinese people are just coming out of nowhere and there's all kinds of carnage, and communications are bad. And then imagine that when if you do get communications, you're not 100% sure what's being said because of that language barrier. That was the situation the Turks were in, where they were receiving orders, things were changing. The situation, of course, was dynamic, and you have all these other factors that, you know, are hard to deal with just on their own. Now, what made the Turks famous in Korea was the Battle of Kunaruri, which was, like I said, around Thanksgiving of 1950. And what they did is they held off a major Chinese assault, which protected the 8th Army and allowed them to retreat. So the Turks had to fight off the Chinese and get themselves out of the mess as well, too. And they did it in a spectacular fashion and saved a lot of American lives. And in the process, they had a lot of hand-to-hand fights. It was just chaos and mayhem everywhere. One thing that happened, just to kind of highlight the communication gap and some of the chaos of the war at this time, was the Turks got into a big battle with what they thought were Chinese forces and ended up taking a bunch of prisoners after a pretty rough hand-to-hand fight. And they turned out to be South Koreans that were retreating. And, you know, they had no way to communicate with these guys. They had no idea that, you know, they couldn't be told that South Koreans would be coming this way. And they kind of had to find out the hard way on that one, how, you know, their mistake. But the Turkish brigade, they were awarded, I believe it was 15 Silver Stars and a few other citations, a presidential unit citation from the government of South Korea for their actions during this flurry of activity there in 1950. Now, their accolades didn't come cheap. In total in Korea, they had 741 guys get killed. And most of these happened during this period. And they had over 2,000 guys get wounded. And, you know, of course, this is a small brigade, so this is a big percentage of their forces were wounded right in this time. But they also had 229 guys get taken prisoner. And of these 229 guys, half of them were wounded. And this is where the idea of Turkish bravery and some of the mythos around these guys really comes into play, I think. And out of these 229 guys that were captured by the North Koreans, none of them died. And if you contrast that to the Americans, I forgot exactly how many we had taken prisoner, but a very large percentage of these guys died under North Korean captivity, which was extremely brutal. You know, of course, it was really cold. These guys were fed basically like raw, like a handful of raw millet a day. It just absolutely brutal conditions. And a lot of the American soldiers and Marines would break down, and it kind of became a every man for himself kind of ordeal, which of course the North Koreans and later the Chinese capitalized on. That was not the case with the Turks. The Turks kept a very strict chain of command amongst the prisoners and a real sense of camaraderie, where if one of the soldiers was wounded, needed some kind of help, that the other soldiers were ordered and obligated to nurse them back to health. The Turks would also split their food up and make sure it was divided, you know, as equal as possible. They also actively resisted the brainwashing that mainly came from their Chinese captors. And now, admittedly, this was going to be easier for the Turks than it would the Americans because, well, for the same reasons the Americans had problems communicating with the Turks, and that was the language barrier. The Chinese certainly added as well, too. But the Chinese did ultimately find people who spoke Turkish that they had access to one way or another and brought them in to, well, chat about communism with the Turkish soldiers. And these guys kind of made sport out of it, where they would ask really dumb questions and pretend that they didn't understand all this as well, too. And it really frustrated the Chinese to the point where ultimately they were kind of left alone. Some even say that it got to the point where the Chinese guards were a little intimidated by the Turks just because the Turks ran so much of a tight ship. Again, we're going to contrast that with the American experience, which was seen as a real embarrassment to the United States. And we did an episode about this actually a while back ago, where we talked about the code of conduct that gave American servicemen guidance on how they were supposed to act in captivity. And part of it was because there were so many cases where American soldiers acted dishonorably, succumbed to brainwashing, and more than that, even threw their fellow prisoners under the bus. There were examples of prisoners that were sick with dysentery that obviously weren't going to be pleasant people to be around, that were thrown outside of the their dwelling, I guess, of some sort, just so the other to die, so the other prisoners wouldn't have to deal with them. And the United States didn't want anything like that again. So that's why we have the code of conduct. That might be something we talk about again, just because it is an interesting subject, but not a problem that the Turks have. Now, there's also something of an urban legend that the Turkish prisoners passed the time by smoking marijuana, which was abundant in North Korea, just, you know, grows naturally there. And Turks knew what it was and just spent their time smoking dope and acting like soldiers, I guess. And some people say that the Turks kind of introduced the North Koreans to the joys of smoking pot, I guess, which I guess smoking marijuana in North Korea is kind of a gray area where it's illegal, but so many people do it. It's just kind of, it's a pretty common thing over there from what I hear, I guess, kind of an interesting story. Now, the Turkish contingent in Korea stayed through the duration of the war. You know, they had to rotate the brigade out a couple of times, but they stayed there until 1954 and in a significant force, then kind of trickled out by 1957. Now, today, there is still a strong connection between the Turkish people and the people of South Korea. It's something that the people of Turkey actually take a lot of pride in, that they their participation in the Korean War was just something worth holding your head up high about. Apparently, there's a park in Seoul called Ankara Park, which is, of course, named after the capital city of Turkey. Now, I talked about watching a movie. I watched it actually this Sunday night. It was very good, called Ayla, Daughter of War. And that's the one I talked about where they ate the powdered eggs. And this is a really fascinating story. And I really like this movie. But anyway, and it's based on a true story. But the Turkish brigade found a young girl that her parents had been killed, and she was just kind of wandering around in the aftermath of a slaughter. And they couldn't find her parents, so they took her under their wing, and she just lived on base with the Turks, and she didn't talk a lot because she was shell-shocked. And ultimately got to a point where she felt like one of the Turkish soldiers was her dad. And she even ultimately called him Baba, which is Turkish for dad. And, because they taught her some Turkish. And he had to get sent back to Turkey. He obviously can't take her back with him. They sent her to a Turkish-ran orphanage. And when he got back to Turkey, he tried to reconnect with this girl. And it was pretty much impossible to find her. Record keepings were so bad. I guess there was a fire in one of the archives. And they didn't really know anything about the girl besides her first name, maybe. So it was hard to really track her down. They just knew the orphanage she went to and this and that. But the film shows their story and then goes to this guy as an old man. And throughout his life, it actually affects him quite a bit, where he's always thinking about this girl that he left behind in South Korea. And every time he sees South Koreans on TV, you know, he kind of stops and watches and thinks that hopefully one of them could be her. But ultimately, they end up finding her, you know, after, what would it be, 60 years of searching. And in 2010, he goes to Korea and meets her in this Ankara Park. And, you know, she's an old lady by now. You know, she's in her 60s and 65 maybe. She's lived her whole life. She's got a couple of kids. And he's a very old man, you know, towards the twilight years of his life, I guess. And finally gets to meet her again. And it's a real emotional moment. And in the film it is. And there's also actual clips on YouTube of the actual meeting where they meet and they just hug and start sobbing uncontrollably and, you know, introduce each other to each other's families. And it was really a very beautiful movie, I thought. Obviously, that's a touching human interest story. But it also had a really good action scene during their time in November of 1950. Which I thought was really cool, and just generally a good movie. Again, that was called Ayla, Daughter of War, spelled A-Y-L-A, and it's in Turkish with U.S. or English and Korean subtitles. So I found the movie in its whole on YouTube with no weird interruptions or anything like that. So definitely look that up. It's worth a watch. All right, so I'm going to leave it there. Again, we're going to start talking about some Cold War issues that have become a lot more relevant in recent times. And we'll do that sooner rather than later. So if you want to support this podcast, the best way to do it is go to reddragonherbs.net and get yourself some tea. This is my company, me and my wife. We're the ones that do it, so you know, it's not the Underwear of the Month affiliate link or anything like that. It's actually us. So check that out. You know, and also check Red Dragon Herbs out on Instagram. My wife is very active there and has gotten really good with Instagram. If you want to get in touch with me, right now about the only social media I'm really keeping up on for the Cold War Cast is our Instagram, of course, at Cold War Cast. I'm also on Twitter. You can send me a message there under The Cold War Cast. You know, I would get that. But, leave ratings, reviews, whatever. And until then, I will talk to you later.